this morning. This morning I want to tell you a story. It's the seventh story in the Book of Serenity. Yaoshan had not ascended the seat to give a Dharma talk for a long time. So the temple administrator said to him, "Everybody has been waiting for a long time for instructions. Please, Master, expound the teaching for the assembly." So Yaoshan had him ring the bell, and when everybody gathered, Yaoshan got up on the seat in the old Chinese monasteries. They had like steps and a big high seat. And he sat there, and after a while he got back down from the seat and went back to his room. And the temple administrator followed after him and said, "You agreed to expound the teaching for the assembly, but you didn't say anything." And Yaoshan said, "For scriptures, there are teachers of scriptures. For the treatises, there are teachers of treatises. How can you question this old monk?" So that's the story. So I really appreciate this story of Yaoshan. What an honest Zen teacher. And I couldn't agree more with his straightforward presentation of Dharma. You know, there really is a place for study of scripture, and there's a place for a philosophical and psychological study of the Dharma. I think that as Dharma students, we shouldn't be dummies, you know, and anti-intellectual, and think that that stuff is not worthwhile and important, because surely it is. Study illuminates the mind, and it definitely helps us in our practice. But study has certain disadvantages. Study may give you the illusion that somehow Dharma is an exact science. Especially nowadays with all these brain things, it may create the illusion that, oh yes, like medication is like, meditation is like medication. You know, you take so many of these and call us in the morning. It may seem as if, you know, Dharma is a perfectly accurate description of reality. That it's a field of expertise to be mastered, more or less. Knowledge to be amassed. You can get to be a really good meditator. So this is not just about studying texts, it's also about meditation practice too, viewed in that same way. And when you look at it that way, it makes you susceptible to the twin manias of either, on the one hand, thinking you know something, which is deadly, or on the other hand, thinking that there is something to be known, but that you, impossible boob that you are, don't know it. Somebody else knows it. And that's even worse than thinking you know something. So either way, you have put yourself deep in the weeds. And Yaozhan is here expressing the true spirit of our practice. We are not trying to master teachings. We are not trying to become the world's greatest meditators. We may be lousy meditators. It really doesn't make that much difference, because there isn't anything to master. And we're not looking for some kind of sudden or accumulated transformative experience. That's not what we're trying to do in our Zen practice. We are just trying to live our lives truly and honestly and compassionately with, we hope, some depth. And if we're going to do this, as it turns out, we're going to have to let go of our lives. We're going to have to see through the conceptual construct that we call our lives. We're going to have to be willing to accept the ultimate unknowability of who and what we are together as a family of existing together beings. We're going to have to appreciate what we are and what we are not. We're going to have to accept that we have nothing, we never did have anything, and we will lose all of that at the end. And the end is right now. And that all of this is absolutely marvelous and beautiful. And we will never come to the end of appreciating it and marveling over it. So, what I just said there is my ridiculously feeble attempt to say what Yaozhan said in a much better way. So, it would be better if I gave a completely wordless talk this morning. And to be honest with you, I was considering it there for a minute. I mean, I had this whole talk, but I thought, well, come on. Yeah, it would be better, you know, if I just sat here. When we were standing there before the Dharma talk, I thought, this is the best, you know. What else do we need? And then just get up and leave, like Yaozhan did. That would be better. That would be truer. And it would also be a lot more impressive, really, if I had done that. Don't you think? Than my going on. I mean, some of you have been listening to my baloney for how many years? 25, 30 years, the same thing over and over again. You know, it's not that impressive anymore. So if I had just left right away, I think that would have really been, that would have got your attention a lot more, I think. But I think it would have felt to me discourteous. So I didn't want to do it. And anyway, isn't talking a great relief, especially after you've been silent for so long? Talking kind of relieves the tension. I think that's why we talk to one another, you know. It's too much to just face each other. Let's talk. It helps, you know. It makes us feel like something's going on. Makes us feel like there's a subject matter, we agree with each other, we don't agree with each other. Something is really happening here, it looks like. So we talk. So here I am, giving a talk, just like the schedule promises. Or, anyway, we could say more accurately, it would appear that I'm giving a talk. The commentary on the case by Wansong, which appears in the Book of Serenity, begins by saying that when people are really hungry and thirsty, they will eat and drink almost anything you give them. Therefore, he says, when there are, I think oddly the way he puts it is, when there are 5 requests from 3 people, or maybe it's 3 requests from 5 people, I don't remember. Probably it's 5 requests from 3 people. Then bodhisattvas have to climb up on the teaching platform. Because bodhisattvas must practice generosity and kindness and compassion, so when they're requested to say something, they must. That they can never not practice compassion, generosity. So I seem to be apparently giving a talk. But so is Yaoshan. He also gets up on the seat. However, it would appear reluctant he was. He did do it. It's just that he's more honest and sincere than I am, and plus, he gives much better talks. He is not entangled by and tempted by words. So the implication of this story is that in Zen, we're looking for something more or less than the teachings. Or maybe we are beyond looking for anything at all. That implication seems typically Zen, doesn't it? You know, paradoxical, mystical. But when you think about it, I don't think it's that mysterious. Because I think that we all know the difference between understanding something or doing something by the book and having a real feeling for it. Doing it with, you know, verve and intuition and love and a confidence and a deep sense of knowing. That's different from doing it correctly and by the book. I think we all know that. And I think the great teacher of this, and the final word on this, is Duke Ellington, right? It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. I think that's about it, right? We know what that feels like. When you learn to play music, or maybe if you're learning to speak a foreign language, you have to do it by the book. You begin by rote, by repetition. There are rules and lessons. You follow the lessons, you follow the rules, you do it correctly, you do it precisely by the book, and you repeat, and you repeat, and you repeat, and you repeat, until finally, one day, haltingly, awkwardly, you say a few sentences. Or you understand a few words. Or maybe you play something and it almost sounds like music. But if you continue, you will stop doing it by the book. You'll have some fluency. You'll be able to play without any thinking. In the case of both music and speech, there's a rhythm and there's a flow. And after a while, you have a facility and you just do it quite naturally with that swing, you know? And then you forget about the book. And maybe, strictly speaking, you no longer know what you're doing. You're just doing it. You can't explain it. If you grew up as an English speaker, I think you would have a hard time explaining, you know, how you speak English. Somebody might say, how did you think about all those words? You just put them together in a sense. There was a verb, there was a subject, there was an object. How did you do that? That's so fast. How did you manage that? And anyway, how can you possibly make the sound f? I can't do that, you know. I can't, no matter how hard I try, I can't say th. Can't do it. Argelia knows my theory of, I'm learning Spanish. And she knows my theory. One morning, I'm going to wake up and start speaking. So far, it hasn't happened. But I'm thinking, if I listen to Spanish enough and I have enough Spanish friends, one morning it's bound to happen. So we can't explain, you know, how we are speaking. It just happens. Naturally. It's obvious. It's beyond obvious. You aren't even doing it somehow. The language is speaking you. The music is playing you. And yet, your ability to speak or play comes from a lifetime of practice. And that practice involves not just thinking about it. Maybe you never thought about it. If you're a native speaker in a language, you never thought about it. It comes from practice, repetition, but also you can't have practice and repetition without some desire and love and concern and some putting your heart into it. And in this way, you express yourself. You're speaking because you want to make a connection. There are meanings that you want to convey to others. They say that children learn language. It's amazing how children learn complex language so quickly, just in a short while. And they say that the reason that they can do that is because they love their mothers and they want to be able to communicate with their mothers. And it's not like they think, I'd like to communicate with my mother. It's like they have an upwelling in the heart that produces, eventually, language expertise. And the same with musicians. They play out of love and they play out of necessity. They are the music. So when Yaoshan got up on that seat, he was expressing, completely expressing his compassion and his generosity. He's saying that yes, he does want to respond to the administrator's request on behalf of the community. He does want to give a helpful Dharma talk. And he does that. The tricky part of the story is that it may seem that it's about silence, about not saying anything. It might even seem that Yaoshan is refusing to speak. But no, this story is about expression. Very similar to what we were talking about yesterday. It's about expression. It's about expressing the truth from the heart without any pretensions in whatever way you find to be able to do that at the time. Yaoshan knows his audience and he's pretty sure that if he were to get up on the seat and give a conventional Dharma talk, as he probably had done many, many times before, maybe the monastics would not really be able to receive his meaning. Maybe they would make something out of it that he wasn't intending. Maybe they would take his words, which were really about their liberation and make those words into more bondage. And goodness knows that we have taken our liberative religions and made them into bondage over the human generations. Haven't we done that? They would take his words and reinforce their confusion and their smallness. Maybe they would. So, Yao Shan decided to make a truer and more generous presentation of his meaning. So he didn't use words, hoping thereby to reduce the chances for misunderstanding. Probably it didn't work. Probably he just created a different kind of misunderstanding. In any case, my point is, he could have given the same talk using words. His talk doesn't depend on not using words. He could have given it with words. And I think that if he had used words with the same spirit with which he had said nothing, using words with the understanding that his purpose was simply to touch his own heart and that of his listeners, not to convey false and misleading promises, then I'm sure his words would have been as eloquent as his non-words. On the other hand, if this is a true story, let's pretend it is, then look what happened. We remember it now for maybe 1,000 years. And it's helping us now to understand our own lives and our own practice. Perhaps if he had given yet another Dharma talk, we would have forgotten it long ago. So as I'm saying here, Yao Shan really did give a complete talk, even without the words. Because don't forget, he did get up on that seat. He arranged his robes. He settled into his sitting posture and was willing to present himself before the assembly. I myself have listened to many thousands of Dharma talks by my teachers over a number of years. And when I look back on all of that, there's no doubt in my mind that my main recollection of the talks is less the words that were said and more the feeling behind the words. And a lot of that feeling was conveyed in the visual experience of watching the teacher, just like Yao Shan, take the seat, arrange her robes or his robes, settle into sitting position. The sound of the voice, never mind the meaning of the words. The sense of the person's presence and their practice, each one unique in all the universe. Facial expressions, gestures, the feeling in the room, the look of the room. These things conveyed the teaching more powerfully than the words. These things express the Dharma beyond the meaning of words. So yes, Yao Shan did give a serious talk. He just so happened not to say anything. So I think we take this to heart for ourselves in our own practice. When we are called on to speak, and I don't mean giving a Dharma talk, but I mean any time we're speaking, could we speak without getting entrapped and entangled in our words, entrapped and entangled in our meanings? Could we speak with our whole bodies, with our hearts, with our souls, connected expressing our love for one another without this entanglement and this distancing and this protection and this inherent misunderstanding. Could we not get caught in that yet again? Could we know what it feels like to speak in that way? And also that means, can we know what it feels like not to speak in that way? Can we know what it feels like to be caught and know it as being caught? Could we let go of what we think we mean and what we think we need to say? And just be present in speaking and in listening to the situation in which we find ourselves. Poor, sad, beautiful creatures, just a handful of us, on a planet spinning in the middle of vast space. Could we remember that? When I give a Dharma talk, I'm always keeping this in mind. I'm always thinking, so what am I trying to do? Well, what's the point of my giving a talk? Do I think I know something that my listeners don't know? Am I trying to explain something to them that they need to know about? No. My Dharma talk is not the same as a sutra or a treatise. Of course, you know, as I say, I'm really interested in Dharma. I find it completely fascinating and wonderful to study. If I'm in a bad mood, I know what'll cheer me up right away. Just read a little Dogen and I'll be happy in a minute, you know. Because study inspires me and it calms me down. And it gives me perspective. It reminds me that most of the stuff that I have on my mind, most of the stuff that bothers me or gets me excited, doesn't really matter in the way that I think it does. So yes, I study, and I encourage everybody who feels like it to study. But there are people who really know a lot, and you have to devote your life to study and nothing but study to really know much. And anyway, I actually did study Buddhism in university so long ago that I pretty much forgot everything that I studied. So maybe when I give a talk, what I should do is try to be as entertaining as possible, because these poor people have been sitting there a long time and all they have is their own impossible minds. So if I could tell some jokes, you know, that would be good. It's a relief, you know, from all that being with yourself. Oh God. Or maybe not jokes. Maybe I need to be inspiring. Maybe I need to be like a Buddhist Tony Robbins, giving motivational speeches and spurring everybody on and giving them a vision to keep going. You know, maybe that's what I need to be doing. Or maybe none of that, but just give Yao Shan's talk over and over again. Practice silence in my words. Because really there is a great healing virtue in that. Don't you find the silence healing? As you know, the Book of Serenity, it's a literary convention of the book that there's always a little paragraph preceding each of the stories. So here's the little introduction or pointer for the story of Yao Shan. Eyes, ears, nose, tongue, each one has ability. The eyebrows are above. warriors, farmers, craftspeople, merchants, each one returns to a job. But the one who has no skills is always relaxed. How does a Chan master devise techniques? That's the introduction to the story. And that part about the eyes and the ears all have ability, but the eyebrows are above. That refers to an old Chinese folk story, which some of you, I'm sure, know. I think I've mentioned it before because it appears every now and then in the stories. So the little Chinese folk story has to do with the parts of the face having a conversation together. The eyes and the nose are all talking to one another. So, of course, the mouth begins the conversation. And the mouth says to the nose, well, you know, I do the eating, which is essential. And also I do the talking. So, clearly I'm the most important. So how come you're above me? I don't get it. And in response, the nose quotes an old Chinese proverb, which says, among the five mountains, the central one occupies the most honorable position. So, the nose says to the eyes, how come you're above me? So then the eyes say, well, we are like the sun and the moon. We have the power of illumination and reflection. So there's no question why we're above you, nose and mouth. But what we don't understand is, what are the eyebrows doing above us? The eyebrows have no skills, you know, they don't do anything. I mean, what good are eyebrows, you know? They have no powers. You can't eat with your eyebrows. You can't speak with your eyebrows, you can't hear with your eyebrows, you can't smell with your eyebrows, you can't see anything. And yet, the eyebrows are the highest. So when the eyes say this to the eyebrows say, well, we are embarrassed, you know, we have no idea why we're up here. and we find it, you know, it's just a little embarrassing. We apologize for being up here. So that's the conversation that happens between the parts of the face. And then a master commenting on this says, in the eyes we call it seeing, in the ears we call it hearing, but what do you call it in the eyebrows? Long silence. And then he says, in sorrow, we grieve together. In happiness, we rejoice together. Everybody knows the useful function, but no one appreciates the supreme power of the useless. So I like to say that our practice is completely useless. It really is, you know. Despite all this, the brain, this, and the plasticity, that, it's totally useless. Someday they're going to disprove all that brain science. They're going to say, whoops, we forgot about this. That invalidates all the rest of it. Completely useless. And that's, the useless to me is so beautiful. So wonderful. I wrote an essay one time called "Do You Want to Make Something Out of It?" in which I argued that it's the uselessness of art that makes us appreciate it so much, although we've forgotten that that's the reason why we appreciate it. When you think about it, I mean, why would someone pay like $100 million for a big piece of canvas with a bunch of paint smudged on it? I mean, I could see where somebody say it's beautiful, I'd like to put it in my living room, but $100 million? You know? I think it's a testimony to how good we are at monetizing even the useless. Because at bottom, we all understand how essential the useless is. Well, why would somebody like me spend the better part of his life writing countless numbers of poems, many of which make absolutely no sense, and nobody reads them anyway? Why would you do that? What's wrong with you, you know? Why would somebody dance or sing, or for that matter, sit here for a whole weekend or a whole week, or say a prayer, or go on a long hike only so that you'll turn around and come back? Why would you do that? Why would you stare out at the ocean or look up at the sky? Well, what good is any of that doing you? No good at all. But without the useless, we couldn't exist. And I am moved by the comment that the master in this story makes to the Chinese face conversation. Life is like that, right? Every life has sorrow and joy. When tough things happen, we feel bad, you know, we feel terrible. We're not going to be cheerful when tough things happen. We do feel terrible. We have grief and anguish. But when we know that that grief and anguish is not some punishment uniquely for we ourselves in our sort of unique badness, but when we know that that sorrow is a sorrow that we all are feeling together, because this happens to us human beings, bad things happen and we grieve, we feel bad. When we know that we're grieving together, it's not so bad. We don't understand. Why did this happen? Why did this happen to me? How is it that someone who was living is now gone? It doesn't make any sense. We don't understand. And our heart aches, but when we know that everybody has this same ache, and even right now in my ache, I feel everyone's ache, it's different. When happiness comes, and it always comes, sometimes, we don't need to feel, I think a lot of us feel like a sneaky kind of guilty feeling. Like, how come I'm happy now? Maybe I shouldn't be happy. Maybe I don't deserve to be happy. Maybe, you know, I'm stealing this happiness. Or worse, it won't last. Which is true. It won't. But when we realize in our moment of happiness that this is not my grabby moment of happiness, this is the happiness human beings feel in a moment like this. We feel it together. I'm feeling it with everyone. And of course, it's literally the case, no doubt. In the moment of happiness, There are no doubt many millions of people on the planet at that very moment feeling happiness, just as in a moment of anguish and grief. At that very moment on the planet, there are millions of people feeling exactly that grief and fear, or whatever it is. When we know that we're in this together, radically together, everything is different. And it's only our encounter and practice with the useless that reminds us of this. Of course, as we all know so well, the useful function is very important. We don't ignore it. We need learning, we need skill, we need to make progress, we need to make improvements, we need to do things. But we have made an absolute mania of this in the world that we're living in now, to the point where there's almost no space left over for anything else but that. We've reduced everything. Now we're even reducing, you know, our spiritual lives to the knowable, the doable, the fixable, the objectified. Of course we need to take control of our lives and of the world. But we can't lose track of what we and the world actually are. A face that was nothing but eyebrows would not be a good-looking face, right? Be weird. We need the eyes and the ears and the nose because they bring a world into our lives. But if we don't also have the useless function, if we don't also respect our not knowing, if we don't also understand the power of simply presence without doing anything, if we forget about the unspoken and the inexpressible, also, this world could not appear. So the eyebrows are very humble, as they should be. They don't know anything, and they don't know why they're above everybody else. But they are. So there's a poem. Also, a convention of the Book of Serenity is that there's a little poem at the end of every case, and here's Hungzhe's poem. Catering to a child's whims with fake money. A great description of the world we live in. A good horse chases the wind, looking back at the whip's shadow. A cloud sweeps the endless sky. A crane nests in the moon. Pure cold penetrates her bones. She's wide awake. The commentary to the case tells us that, to the poem, tells us that in old China, when a child was crying, parents would gather some golden leaves and wave them in front of the child's faces and tell them that this was money. Somehow that would cheer them up, I guess. When you read books about, you know, Asian cultures, it always says, the Chinese are very practical people. Whereas the Indians are very exotic and spiritual and bizarre, you know. So that's interesting that, you know, the Buddhism that we practice is a combination of both India and China and Japan too. Well, I guess you would become a very practical person if from childhood people were waving leaves in front of you telling you it was money. Weird. And so the line, this line, catering to a child's whims with fake money, that is a line that refers to me giving my Dharma talk, right? I'm catering to children's whims by giving you a bunch of dried up leaves, which I'm telling you is money. And look, you're happy. It worked. In the next verse, a good horse chases the wind, looking back at the whip's shadow, refers to another story. That's the trouble with these Zen things. Everything refers to something else, you know, and you have to go look up everything. So, and you know, they did a computer analysis of, did you know this? They did a computer analysis of Shobo Genzo, Dogen's text, and they found out that almost everything he wrote was already copied, you know, like it was already appeared earlier in the canon. There was no phrase, hardly any phrase at all, that everybody thought, Dogen said this, but actually he got it from here and he got it from there. You know, in our world, originality is very important. We should be original. You get bad marks for plagiarism. But in old China and Japan, you should plagiarize everything. God forbid, any original thought is suspect, probably wrong, right? If somebody already didn't think it before, it's probably wrong. But I realized some years ago that every time I had a brilliant original thought, and I used to think I had brilliant original thoughts, at some point it dawned on me that if I'm having this brilliant original thought, what that must mean is that somebody else is also has already had or is right now having this brilliant original thought. And it's proven to be absolutely true. Every original thought I ever had, actually I was remembering something I read a long time ago that I forgot. Anyway, that was all an aside. Now I have to tell you the story about the horses. This is a story from the Buddha's time. So a so-called outsider, an outsider is a term that means somebody who's not practicing, doesn't know the practice. An outsider comes to the Buddha, and this is in the Pali Sutras, and the outsider says, and you can see the relevance to our story here, I don't ask about the spoken, and I don't ask about the unspoken. What is it that's beyond both? And guess what the Buddha said? Nothing. Right? He didn't say anything. He, just like Yaoshan. In fact, that's probably where Yaoshan got it from, right? Yaoshan's silence was just imitating the Buddha's silence. The Buddha was silent on a number of occasions. This was one of them. Well, seeing the Buddha's response to his question, the outsider got very excited, began bowing in front of the Buddha in gratitude, and excitedly said, the world honors one, honored one's great compassion has opened the clouds of my illusion and allowed me to gain great insight. He was really happy about this, and he went away. And Ananda was standing there shocked at this whole thing. And Ananda said, what just happened there? What did the outsider get that I still don't seem to understand? And the Buddha said, he is like a good horse. As soon as he sees the shadow of the whip, he goes. So then the Buddha explains that there are four kinds of horses. You've heard about this probably. There are four kinds of horses. There's one who goes like this outsider when he just sees the shadow of the whip. There's one who has to be whipped considerably till the flesh, you know, notices the whipping, one who has to be whipped all the way down to the bone, and one who has to be whipped even to the marrow. And the reason why you might know about this story is because Suzuki Roshi famously commented on the story, and he said something like, of course, everybody thinks that they should be like the first horse. The good student, we all want to be the good student who gets it, right? That's what is important, to be the good student who gets it. But Suzuki Roshi said, no, we don't want to be like that. It's much better to be the fourth horse. The one who has to be whipped again and again and again and never gets it for decades. The smart has to penetrate all the way to the marrow for this horse. And Suzuki Roshi liked that story and said that because he always said that he was that kind of a Zen student. He always said that he became the abbot of Rinso In because he had a very tough teacher, and all the other disciples of his tough teacher were smart enough to figure out how to escape. And they all escaped. But he couldn't figure out how to escape, so he became the abbot. And I also appreciate this because that's exactly what happened to me too. The way I tell it, this is like a metaphor for it, but basically it's like that old story, maybe you saw it in the movie, like some World War II movie where all the soldiers are lined up and the guy says, okay, whoever wants to volunteer for this difficult assignment, take one step forward. And the entire line takes one step back, except for one guy who's just left standing there, who gets the assignment. That's what happened to me. That's how I got to be the abbot of Zen Center. All the people who were ahead of me in seniority and much smarter and more talented, they all figured out that they could get out of there and do something else, and I couldn't figure out how to do that. So, here I am. And this is very much characteristic of our style of practice. We are not the most brilliant. I'll always say, our food is good though. We are not the most brilliant and the most enlightened. But we do keep on going. We keep on going. We're going to do a precept ceremony, Jukai ceremony this afternoon in a few hours with David. And I will be asking David, so David, even after you become a Buddha, will you keep on going? And David is going to say, yes, I will. Because that's what the fourth horse does. No matter what happens, keeps on going. Even if you're not too enlightened, even if you have a lot of troubles and flaws and are constantly falling down, actually after a while it becomes even better. Because anyway, you just keep going. And that is truly inspiring, you know. It's actually probably pretty easy to get enlightened, you know. It's much harder to just keep going for a long time, even after acquiring Buddhahood. The teaching penetrates right through to the marrow. A cloud sweeps the endless sky. A crane nests in the moon. Pure cold penetrates her bones. She's wide awake. So this is a bracing image of awakening. A cloud sweeps the endless sky. Yes, there are many clouds covering the sun in the course of a lifetime. Lots of crises and troubles and challenges. But when you know that the sky in which the cloud appears is endless, you can let the cloud appear knowing it will just dissolve, float by in the endless sky. And when you see the cloud, you also see the sky. Pure cold penetrates the bones. A white crane nesting in the white moonlight. You can't see a white crane in the moonlight. It's very hiddenness is its virtue and its beauty. And moonlight is great, isn't it? Everything is the same color in the moonlight. Everything is silver. It doesn't seem real. Maybe it hardly exists at all except in a dream. Dogen actually commented on this story of Yashan ascending the seat. And I'll just end with Dogen's comment, which I find interesting and valuable, and I think it adds something to what we're saying. Dogen writes, "What Yashan taught is that a fist has a fist teacher and an eyeball has an eyeball teacher. However, you should ask Yashan. It's not that I expect something from you, but what kind of a teacher are you?" Unexpected comment. So Dogen here meets Yashan. He's saying, you know, there are a million ways to express the teachings. Yashan's way is a good way. There are other ways too. Everyone, as we were saying yesterday, has the challenge of finding her own way, his own way of being in this practice, in this life. So the point of contemplating these old stories is not to be intimidated by them or set them up as some sort of external standard of awakening. The point is to just appreciate them, to take them into our hearts. Sometimes we find a story that we have affinity with that story. That's our story. Sometimes we say, well, I can appreciate that, but that's not for me. The point is not that every story has to be for you, or every person you meet, or everything in this world has to be for you, but every person you meet, everything in this world, every story you hear, you have to take it in your own way. In order to be who you are, you have to let others be who they are, right? That's how you be you who you are. You have to see others, see other ways. And then in that way you find your own way. So a fist has a fist teacher, an eyeball has an eyeball teacher, but we can't leave it at that. We engage. So Dogen appreciates Yashan's teaching. He has no expectations that Yashan should have been otherwise. But he says to him, okay, so what kind of a person are you? Let's talk. In other words, he engages, he questions. We have to engage our lives. We have to engage one another. We have to engage the teaching. We appreciate, but we engage. We don't just leave it alone. So Jerry Shishin Wick has a commentary on Book of Serenity, a contemporary commentary, and in that commentary he tells the last story of Yashan's life. When Yashan was 84 years old, he went running up and down in the temple shouting, "The walls are falling in! The walls are falling in! The walls are falling in!" And all the monastics went around like trying to shore up the pillars, and they were all upset. And Yashan said, "No, no, no, you did not understand what I was saying." And then he went into his room and died. Yes, folks, the walls are falling in. The walls are falling in. No doubt. And if you're a good temple administrator, you should rouse the abbot and say, "Hey, look, it's time for a Dharma talk. Get up there and do your job." And when the abbot gets up on the seat and doesn't say anything, you should run after him back to his room and say, "Whew, What the hell was that? The monks are in need. And when the walls are falling down, you should try to shore them up. You know, call the repair crew. You have a list of craftsmen and repair people. Call them up. Fix it. But in the end, you won't fix it. In the end, it can't be fixed. The walls fall down. And words cannot express our feeling. Everything disappears. Even as I speak, everything is disappearing. We are disappearing right now. We can't forget that. So, how's that for a silent talk? More words than you probably needed to hear. But that's the way it goes. So I want to, again, thank everybody for coming and thank Mountain Rain for hosting. And I hope everybody will be there for our ceremony. When we receive and give precepts, it's everybody in the assembly receives and gives precepts. So it's a blessing to come to a ceremony and witness it and take it into your heart. So please do continue your practice. I know you will. On and on. As we say in the ceremony this afternoon, throughout this life and in times to come. So thank you. May our intention